Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Friday, February 2nd, 2024. And thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate your viewership here at the Eastman Financial Report and all across our programming on WVW-TV. As you know, WVW-TV is not a commercial network. We don't sell advertising and we're not beholden to advertisers. We're able to offer our content as designed and created by our various programs. And we offer that information into the great marketplace of ideas that makes not only the American experience so rich in thought, but also globally. And of course, that takes a little bit of time and a little bit of money. And we appreciate all of our viewers and those of you who find time in your busy day to donate to the WVW-TV Foundation. It's a great way for you as a viewer to help support this effort, this ministry, this mission. And that's an easy thing to do. You go to WVWFoundation.com and you can make a donation if you feel like it. Keep in mind that we are on 24 hours a day. We have plenty of live broadcasting, and of course, there's plenty of recorded programs. So if you happen to be busy during the 11:30 to 12 period of time during the day, you can always watch me at 2 o'clock in the morning on the reruns. And all that happens, it takes a rather large budget to do that. I mean, obviously, WVW-TV has been around since 2006, and we're bringing very, very good content to the marketplace of ideas, and that takes money. So we appreciate any help you can find to send our way, and certainly we appreciate more than that your viewership, just your ability and your interest in the materials we have to offer. As you know, the programming of here is also funded to an extent by sponsors, and of course the sponsor of my program has been Swiss America Trading, which is an American company based in Arizona, and they sell precious metals. So if you're looking at the idea of purchasing precious metals for either investment or ownership or collection or gifting, you might want to give them a call at 1-800-519-6271. The number's on the bottom of the screen there. And you can ask them, tell them Dan Eastman sent you from the Eastman Financial Report, and they'll be happy to send you free information as to how that market works. You can also go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, and you can shop around and see what they have to offer and the various and different types of ways you can own gold and silver and precious metals. There are gold coins, of course, silver coins, and there are different kinds and ways that gold and silver finds its way into coinage. A very popular way for people to invest in precious metals is to purchase gold and silver and platinum coins that are minted by national mints, like the U.S. Mint mints gold and silver coins and platinum coins for the American consumer. And of course, by an act of Congress, they're required to use American gold and silver. You can dig it up here and turn it into coins. And that's a convenient way for people to buy gold and silver and platinum, knowing that the size of the coin, if it's a 1 ounce coin, you know there's an ounce of gold in it at a certain high level of purity. And that's an important thing when you're going to spend your money on precious metals, whether for investment or collection or whatever. You want to make sure you're getting what you're paying for. And that's why you would want to use a vendor in that space that is reputable and experienced and well-regarded. And Swiss America checks all those boxes. They're a great company. They've been around a very long time, been a great supporter of WVW-TV, and they're populated by people who do this full time. This is their day job. So when you go and ask them questions about the precious metals market, you can expect to receive some very high quality answers. And also, when you purchase the precious metals, you want to make sure you're getting an authentic piece. And that's a thing. And of course, you can buy gold and silver online all day long. You can buy it from big box retailers. You can buy it from, you know, all over the place. But when you're spending your money, you want to make sure you're buying it from somebody who will back the quality and the quantity so that you get what you pay for. And that's where Swiss America comes in spades. They are really professional in the space, happy to help you out. They're not a high pressure operation. And if you call them or go to their website, you'll see what they have to offer. And with the information they provide, you can see if that investment is right for you. And of course, you are the final decision maker and you would want to have the facts. So that's why you tune into WVW-TV and the Eastman Financial Report. We don't sell stuff. We give you facts and you make up your own mind. And that's important. So Swiss America is a great company and we appreciate their sponsorship and their long-term support of our efforts here. So give them a call or reach out to them and tell them Dan Eastman sent you from the Eastman Financial Report. Okay, let's jump into the news, and I want to be a little more analytical. If you've been watching me consistently, you know I'm moving from rattling off the headlines, like a lot of what you see in the financial news, to actually taking the time to think through these headlines and try to figure out what they mean. And of course, there's no easy path when you deal with information that has to do with wealth and money and investment. There is always an agenda involved. And if you think about it from the purest point, I would lecture my students on this, is to step back and think about what it means. You're watching a financial show because you have an interest in finance or money or the economy. And you have that interest because you will want to be in a better place rather than a worse place. That's that rational economic thought concept that we teach in Economics 101. Nobody goes into the economy thinking, how could I lose money today? Unless you have some clever tax planning, people don't like to lose money. They like to make money. And that's why you fill your mind with information from this source, the Eastman Financial Report, but of course, many other sources as well. There's huge big name media in financial reporting, always has been, always will be, because it's very important. People are trying to better themselves and protect what they have and maybe grow some more. And in order to do that, you need information and knowledge. And that's why that marketplace of ideas is so important on a national level, because you want to be able to look at and analyze the news stories as they come in to see which is factual and which is agenda driven. Somebody's trying to run the market up and they'll put out a news story, or they're trying to crater the market because they've shorted it and they're putting out a news story. You have to be able to sort through this, especially when you're putting your own wealth or assets at risk. You want to be able to think through this stuff and be skeptical. I guess that would be I think if you would write that on your final exam, you'll get an A+. Is at the end of the day, what I've learned is not a magic formula for wealth, but to be skeptical of the news I read. And this is a big market, and there are a lot of huge, huge money players, and there's a lot at stake. So when you're the average American, you're sitting here in the Middle West and you're trying to figure out where the economy's going so you can kind of protect your wealth and or make some money, you have to realize that there are big voices, big powerful voices, putting stories out all the time with an agenda. And the sophisticated mind will say, what is... They hear the stories and they look for the agenda. I'll use Warren Buffett as an example. I mean, he's a Midwestern guy. He's been world renowned. He's probably one of the greatest investors who's ever breathed oxygen. He's a fantastic person. And at the end of the day, if you look at his investment style, he is very skeptical and digs and digs and digs to find value. And this isn't a plug for Warren Buffett, and no, he doesn't sponsor my show, but I'm impressed with him as a Midwest guy who obviously has done well for himself in life. And at the end of the day, if you look at that type of ability to see a matrix of stories and then read between the lines and swim through the stories to start to look for value, you're better off. And that's the whole purpose of this series. When I agreed to do this series, I said, well, we'll take the lecture in the classroom on practical critical thinking of economic thought into the marketplace of ideas and see if anybody's interested in listening. And I have to say, not to pat myself on my own back, but I do my show prep probably 24/7 because I'm aware of what I need to think about and what are the hot issues and what are the stories bubbling. And I am happy to be consistent with the voices of many, many very prominent financial talking heads. Okay. And it oftentimes at first surprised me that I was right there with the rest of them. But it when you stop to think about it, I was having a discussion with an Austrian economics hard money person that I know. And he and I are on the same page philosophically, so it would make sense that as words come out of our mouth, they're going to sound similar, because this is how we view the world. And I think that's consistent. But what's refreshing, and I say this to my millions of viewers worldwide, that oftentimes I'll say something and I'll see it in the financial press the next day. And quite frankly, sometimes I'll see something in the financial press and say it the next day. But the point is, there's a consistency of the message. And the consistency of the message from our perspective, our viewpoint, our optic, is that the the financial system is grossly out of whack at the moment, and it behooves our political leaders to bring it back into whack. I guess if it's out of whack, you want to bring it back into whack. You want to bring this thing into a sense of balance. And because the system is not in balance, this is creating some real concern in the minds of many that it's not just the economy, stupid, as Bill Clinton said, although in an election year it certainly is, but the economy we have looked at as being the biggest economy in the world, the United States. And that's a fine thing when you're emerging from World War II and most of the world is in shambles or third world or undeveloped and it was coming together. But we have had decades where the world is forming itself into very interesting blocks. And of course, the people that live in those different blocks have, you know, as much interest in a good life and a wealthy life as Americans do. So what we're seeing is things like the BRICS that are coming together. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and then a bunch of others, which they've, you know, BRICS sounds good, but you can't keep adding letters. But at the end of the day, that becomes an alternative bloc. We saw an alternative bloc coming with the European Union. And of course, that was a bit of a conundrum, because if you look at various and sundry European currencies that were pegged to the dollar at Bretton Woods, well, that model sort of ran out of steam and they merged them all together into the euro. And of course, the Germans were on the lead of the euro because they're the biggest manufacturers and they'd have the most to gain. Well, now we deal with a euro market and we deal with a BRICS market. And then, of course, when you think of Russia, China, and India, those are big places. Now, Russian population is small, it's dwindling. And that's a problem, but it's also the largest landmass on the globe, which is a real problem for the Russians because they got a lot of land and nobody living there. And but the point is that those are big population centers with Russia and India. You're looking at 3 billion people in those two countries alone, and you're looking at 330 million Americans that are $34 trillion in debt. You know, you don't stay on top of the heap by spending yourself broke, running around the globe doing things that don't produce a return for the treasury. And unfortunately, we have been in a mindset since World War II that the United States has infinite wealth and can spend infinite money and solve infinite problems, when in fact our population is being taxed to the point that makes serfdom in the Middle Ages look like a deal. Because in the Middle Ages, if you read the literature, the serfs were complaining. The serfs were everybody but the nobility and the royalty were complaining about a 10 to 15% tax. Boy, wouldn't we love to be paying a 10 or 15% tax right here in the good old USA? We're not. When you look at federal tax, state tax, sales tax, income tax, all the taxes, Social Security tax, Medicare tax, what you realize is that like half your income is going to support the government. And at that point, which is fine. I mean, you could have a socialist country like Sweden or something that we're going to have high taxes, but we're going to have a nice big social safety net, so everybody's comfortable, but they're not world leaders. And you don't see Sweden invading, you know, five countries a week. And you don't see that because they can't afford it. The treasury can't afford it. Even though the taxes in Sweden, they have some friends who live in Sweden, the taxes are very high. They're very high. And they have a nice level of social platform. You know, education is free. They'll say, well, I get free college. I said, no, you're paying, 70, 80, 90% of your income for your entire life. It's not free. It's just, you didn't have to pay a tuition bill, but you're certainly paying for the college and the faculty and the facilities. So the point is, we're at a point in the U.S. history where this is becoming a real thing. And I think you see that throughout the literature and the media, especially if you're looking at the hard money crowd. And of course, we're outside of the mainstream, so you got to put your tinfoil hat on, and you got to put your I'm a kook t-shirt on. But the reality is, from an economic, an academic perspective, there are various thoughts in economic circles. Of course, you've got the classical Adam Smith economics of supply and demand, laissez-faire economy. In the long run, the markets will find equilibrium. Then you've got the Keynesian crowd that says, yes, in the long run, we're all dead. We got to fix problems in the short run. And by the way, if you add the Keynesian multiplier, you can bankrupt your government. Just ask the Germans in the 1920s. And then, of course, you've got the Marxist crowd who say economics is exploitive and everybody should just have, the the same. And of course, that's, you know, defies human nature. Man's sinful human nature is always to watch out for yourself at the expense of your neighbor. And that was a big problem. When Jesus walked the earth, he was saying there's two rules. Number one, love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. And number two, this is the hard one, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, you know, people don't do that. And that's why there's, you know, that's why you need a savior, because nobody worries about their neighbor more than they worry about themselves. So the point is, from an economic perspective, when you start pushing different economic models, you have to understand human nature as it exists. And, you know, for, you know, pick a number, you know, how many thousands of years humankind has existed, but human nature is very, very consistent. If you read literature from the Babylonian era, that's been, of course, translated into English, you will see the same types of, you know, greed and debauchery. If you read anything from the Roman Empire, again, translated into English, unless you read Latin, you will see the same types of debauchery and, you know, greed and self-interest. So as you go through life, economists and the dismal science of economics, you try to analyze human nature and from a different mathematical perspective. And that's why we get these different trains of thought. And of course, you've got the classical economists of Adam Smith, and you've got the Keynesians, and you got the Marxists. And of course, there's these hard money guys coming around saying, you know what? Money ought to be more than just a concept. It ought to actually have a unit in space and time. And in the olden days, a silver coin or a gold coin was a unit of value occupying a space in a period of time. And the beautiful thing about precious metals, of course, is that time horizon is very long. Gold and silver don't rust. I enjoy sometimes surfing the net and reading archaeological discoveries. It always fascinates me. And they dig up something from Mesopotamia or, you know, England from the, you know, the 200s, and they find a gold object and they wash it off, and it's as beautiful and pure as it was that, you know, when it was made thousands of years ago. And that shows you why precious metals have over millennia have become a store of value, because oddly, in a world that atrophies and everything starts out fresh and then deteriorates and then finally dissipates. You look at people, you know, children and young people are, you know, very, you know, they look young, and then you get to be middle-aged, and then you get to be old like me, and then you start, you know, you start deteriorating. Well, that's with everything. You know, trees don't last forever, and you know, a wooden house will eventually decay, and even the brick homes, you know, the bricks fall apart, the mortar lets loose. The point is that very few things can transcend millennia, and gold and silver does that. This isn't necessarily a sales pitch for gold and silver. It's just the reality. So when the hard money guys come along, the Austrian school of economics and von Mises and all these thinkers in that space, what they're saying is, You need to have a currency in your economy that will last longer than you do, and effectively will preserve wealth beyond the period of normal atrophy for organic matter. Okay, so at the end of the day, that's where that idea comes from, and it's not without criticism. You know, we'd love to say we'll go back to the gold standard. Well, we were on the gold standard, and President Roosevelt, it's an amazing story. He and the Treasury Secretary, they said, we're going to peg the dollar to gold to stabilize things, okay? And this is the 1930s during the Depression. He said, well, you know, how many dollars per ounce of gold? And they literally just picked $36 out of thin air. It was just, okay, yeah, this sounds good. Okay, let's do 36. That became the monetary standard for the entire globe. We went through World War II, and then there was Bretton Woods when we had to reconstruct the money system. And lo and behold, there's that $35 or $36 per ounce of American dollars per ounce of gold. And that became the global monetary standard from the late 1940s right up until, well, when President Nixon in 1971 detached the dollar from gold, and we had hard money. But did we have hard money? That's the question. You know, you think about it. Well, you know, it was $35. I'll say $35. It was a little bit of a formula thing, but let's just say $35 for an ounce of gold. If you took $35 to the federal bank, you know, they give you an ounce of gold. Okay. Well, the problem is, and that was a hard money situation, that the dynamics of a representative democracy like America, where you have a Congress that can deficit spend will always will require more money than the taxpayers are willing to shell out. You don't see that at the local level, and you don't see that at the state level, because states and local governments are required to have a balanced budget. So if the state of Wisconsin has a $50 billion budget per year, they're going to take $50 billion from the people and the businesses, and then they're going to reallocate it, and that's going to be the state spending. But they don't run a deficit. Sometimes you can run a surplus and you put that in a rainy day fund, but then the taxpayers start to holler about that. Hey, you overtaxed me. You took more money than you needed. Well, it's nice to have a little cushion, but that's how they run. The federal government doesn't have that, and we know that. So at the end of the day, if the federal government is, and the federal government today does not issue our currency, that's a big debate. In the old days, like the greenbacks and the Continental Congress, that the government would issue a currency and it would circulate in the economy. The problem is, in a growing economy, you always need more money. And if you're on a pure gold standard, and this is the problem we had back in the 1800s, when they were digging up, the West and the mountains and Nevada and Colorado and all those famous silver and gold mining towns, the idea was that the gold would come in and it would end up where the federal government would pay for that gold from the miners, and then that would become the gold base, and they would issue currency against that, those ounces. But no matter how they set the formula, it was never, they always were printing more money than there was gold. And effectively, it was an illusion that they effectively, instead of saying $35 an ounce, it would be 150 or 500 or whatever. Well, by the 1970s, the amount of dollars in circulation vastly outstripped the gold. And at the end of the day, Nixon realized that he had to pull the plug on this linkage and let the currency float, because what had happened, this goes back to the beginnings of the Vietnam War, when Indochina, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, that was all a French colonial area. And they were losing their grip. They were losing control because Mao Zedong had basically done the Chinese Revolution in 1949, and it was pressure to communize the whole part. And the French were running an economic colony. They didn't want to lose their economics. They didn't have the ability to fight off not only the locals, but also the Republic of China. So they came to the United States and said, hey, you got to preserve our little colonial empire here. We don't want to lose this. And the United States is like, no, we're really not interested, because we just got our heads handed to us in Korea, and we're not basically going to go back into Vietnam just to protect French interests. And the French said, we know something that you don't think we know. And they said, yeah, what? He said, we know that you guys have issued vastly more dollars than there are gold bars in Fort Knox. And if we show up with our dollars, we want the gold because it's convertible. Well, Kennedy administration is like, oh, man, this is not a good thing. So at the end of the day, they get involved in Vietnam. And then, of course, by the time Lyndon Johnson comes along, he's really fighting Vietnam. And then by the time Nixon came along, and keep in mind, Nixon was the vice president under Eisenhower, and he knew a lot. He was also a very effective prosecutor in California. And his idea was, he knew that basically the French had called him out, and his strategic reaction was to delink. And of course, the minute he delinked, inflation blew through the roof because there's so many dollars out there. Well, we're in an interesting period in time that sort of reflects that today. And that's why, in a pure hard money system, if you had X tons of gold and you issued X numbers of dollars, you would very quickly find out that it would take, coins, penny. For a penny, you could buy a gallon of gas, because money would become so valuable because it would be so scarce. Instead of flooded with all the paper money and now the digital money that's flooding the globe, American dollars, if you had a dollar in your hand, that would be a scarce commodity, if it was truly convertible to the pile, to the number of ounces sitting back in Fort Knox, you'd become very rich. And instead of paying, $80,000 for a car, you might be able to buy a car for $4 backed by gold because of the ratios. So it's not an easy thing to convert back to a gold standard. And of course, you can always do it in a derivative model or some quasi, formulaic model. But every time you do that, the stimulus and the propensity to create more dollars than there are ounces of gold or silver or both is always there. And we've seen this in the cyclical time. The Germans did this back in the early 1900s, they had this idea they're going to fund World War One based on printed money. And by the 1920s, first of all, they lost the war. The reparations were crushing them. And by the time the 1920s came along, the hyperinflation was a disaster, which, of course, led to the rise of the Nazi Party and Adolf Hitler. And then World War II, which led to the death of millions and millions of people and the destruction of old Europe. So these are not fun things. You don't do this stuff willy-nilly. I mean, when you think about it from an academic perspective, it's fun to debate, you know, the merits of Adam Smith versus Karl Marx versus the hard money versus Keynes versus socialism, all this stuff. But at the end of the day, implementing this is always done after the fact, and it's always after the fact of some major disaster. So it would behoove our government to just kind of get their fiscal budget in order, and it's not quite clear what's going on. And that leads me to the headline story of the day. As I'm prepping today, I'm looking at, you know, the big story out this morning is the jobs number has exploded. It's gone up. It's 353,000 new jobs were created in January. Wow, well, that's interesting. But yesterday I was talking about 224,000 people hitting the unemployment lines. But now today there's 353,000 new jobs, and unemployment is shown to be 3.7%. Now, those are great numbers. I mean, if you are the president of the United States running for re-election, you want to say, we're creating jobs like crazy. Unemployment is very low, and 3.7 is not the lowest it's ever been, but it certainly is not a screaming headline of, you know, soup kitchen lines. It's a good number. And of course, when you look at it, the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts the number out, and in December, they revised the jobs. And that's the thing I've been talking about, is revising these numbers that create a headline. And of course, in December, they said it was 216,000 jobs, new jobs. Well, now they've revised that to 333,000 jobs last month versus 353,000 jobs this in January. So it starts to look like, oh boy, the economy's really taken off and jobs are being created and, you know, unemployment is low. This is great. And so you ask yourself the question, why am I reading this? How does this factor in? Because there's an agenda behind these numbers, because they're so counter. We know that UPS had a big threat of a strike last summer. I commented on that. And of course, the union settled with UPS. So they got a great big raise package over 3 years. It was a nice package. Well, in December, in January, they now announced they're laying off 12,000 people, not drivers, but, you know, the overhead people, you know, people in, you know, in the administration. And every time you take a look at these numbers with respect to the job market, you're not seeing a robust exploding economy. But yet on all the major media, and I'm checking all the headlines, you know, big story today, boy, jobs are up. So you have to ask yourself the question, why am I seeing that? Why? And what does that mean? And what is happening with respect to this data? And that's why if you were going to take a position in the stock market today, or, you know, buy a bond or something, the idea is, if you read that headline and you react as whoever generates the headline expects, you would do A. And I think Warren Buffett would tell you do B. I shouldn't speak for Warren. You can ask him yourself. But I think he would tell me that, or at least if he didn't, I'd tell him that. You know, let's take a look at, you know, let's look beyond the headlines. So I thought that was an interesting number. And then the University of Michigan survey, those are sentiment surveys, come out. And of course, the inflation survey has dropped to 2.9%. The people whom they survey are expecting to see lower inflation, and that pushes up their sentiment number as well. I mean, if people are thinking, well, inflation will be under control, you know, I'm feeling better about the economy, so I'll tell the University of Michigan surveyor that I'm feeling better, and then of course the index goes up. But the question becomes, how does the person develop the idea to respond to the surveyor? And it's the answer is they read these headlines. And then this is what forms public opinion. And then that public opinion is broadcast. And then the survey folks pick it up. And of course it's going to reflect in the responses of the people they surveyed. They just saw the headline. Yeah, it must be true. So you have to kind of work your way through all of that. And I'm out of time for today. We'll pick it up on Monday. But thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for watching WVW-TV and the Eastman Financial Report. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.